Here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Wednesday, September 4th, 2013 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Wednesday in the 3 o'clock hour is Pentagon Solutions, where we hear from experts both inside and outside the building. Today you're hearing highlights from an event at the Heritage Foundation with Seth Cropsey. He's former Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy, now a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. He's author of Mayday, The Decline of American Naval Supremacy. He talks about the book and the concept throughout the course of this program. And in our first highlight, he talks about the very basics of the Navy's struggles by defining what Mayday actually means and how it describes its present-day challenges.
Mayday is an anglicized form of Medea. French for help me. It's the international shorthand that mariners and aviators use to declare an emergency and request help. I chose this as the title for the book, which is the subject of this afternoon's event, because American sea power is in trouble. The last official statement of U.S. maritime strategy was published 6 years ago. With acknowledgement of U.S. sea power's traditional role as a nuclear and conventional deterrent, projecting power, responding to crises, showing the flag around the world, the 2007 strategy emphasized cooperation with other navies and humanitarian missions. These, the document said, would help prevent wars, a policy that I think is inconsistent with American foreign and military policy of the past, which has usually responded rather than anticipated conflict. More important, the Navy's 2007 strategy did not mention the word China, as you pointed out, not once. Naval spokesmen have justified this oversight as a means of avoiding unnecessarily antagonizing China. Yet China has made it clear in word and deed that its policy is to deny the United States access to the Western Pacific. With U.S. access to the Western Pacific in doubt, our ability to honor our commitments to the five nations with which we have security treaties in East and Southeast Asia would be called into question. China is building a ballistic missile system intended to target large American vessels, read aircraft carriers, such underway at sea at a distance of up to 1,200 miles. China has conducted cyber attacks against the U.S. government as well as industry. It has declared that the international waters of the South and East China Seas lie within its sovereign grasp. Its military budget continues, as it has for over two decades, to increase by double-digit figures from year to year. It has built a formidable array of surface-to-surface and surface-to-air missiles and continues amassing an arsenal of these weapons immediately across the straits from Taiwan. Despite this administration's implicit shift from the Middle East wars it has drawn to a close, the Persian Gulf will remain volatile and dangerously so if Iran becomes a nuclear power. Some of you may have read the Washington-based Institute for Science and International Security a report that was published on Tuesday this week, that predicted that Iran will be able to produce weapons-grade uranium by the middle of 2014 without being detected. In addition, as current events demonstrate, the Levant and Maghreb are in turmoil. Turkey has reversed direction and is pursuing Islamist domestic and foreign policies that are the equal of its Ottoman past. Syria is in the midst of a horrific civil war. We must rely on the Egyptian military's prudence to avoid a similar outcome in the Arab world's greatest state. And recent developments in Tunisia don't look promising either. The Eastern Mediterranean has reverted to the instability that characterized it for most of recorded history. And the U.S. Sixth Fleet, our Mediterranean naval force, which once included two carrier battle groups, consists today of a command ship based in Italy and three or so surface ships equipped with ballistic missile defenses. In the Mediterranean, the soft power that the Obama administration favors is in fact unsupported by hard power. Into the vacuum left by our departure, others are stepping. Iran has sent a frigate and a much larger helicopter carrier into the Mediterranean. China last year ordered a destroyer, a guided missile frigate, and a logistics vessel into the Med. And this year, at least up until now, has deployed two guided missile frigates, which have called it Algeria, Malta, Morocco, and France. Russia currently has 16 ships on station in the Med and plans a rotational schedule that will allow a permanent presence for now of 12 ships. Moscow is also seeking to reach a basing agreement with Cyprus that would allow Russian combat aircraft and vessels to use an airfield at Paphos in the western part of the island and at the southern port of Limassol. However, my point here, which is also noted in the book, is not so much to paint a picture of what I regard as troublesome military developments in the Mediterranean or even in China, that affect us and our allies. It's rather to emphasize that contrary to the Navy's 2007 maritime strategy of preventing wars, neither U.S. naval nor national leadership has acknowledged that we are, in fact, in a strategic competition with China that requires diplomatic and military strategy, as well as the resources to support it.
That's Seth Cropsey. He's former Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy and now a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, speaking at the Heritage Foundation. You can read more later today about his presentation and his book on the sea power of the Navy called May Day, The Decline of American Naval Supremacy at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. More Pentagon Solutions coming up on In Depth with Francis Rose. Continuous monitoring through the Security Connected Framework from McAfee. Built on more than two decades of proven security practices, the Security Connected approach helps agencies improve security posture, optimize security for greater cost effectiveness, and align security strategically with mission objectives. Visit futureagency.com to learn more. That's futureagency.com. For each unique visitor to futureagency.com, $1 will be donated to the Wounded Warrior Project.
Accenture, high performance delivered. It's how we help clients take on their most complex challenges. We helped process $650 billion in benefit payments for U.S. federal organizations. And we helped eliminate $348 million in U.S. federal fleet, inventory, and freight costs. With unmatched capabilities across defense, public safety, and civilian, Accenture consistently delivers results at speed. To learn more, visit Accenture.com/federal or follow us on Twitter at AccentureFed.
This week's Experts in Health topic is outdoor safety, featuring Dr. Kadlicek, an infectious disease physician with the Mid-Atlantic Permanente Medical Group who practices at Kaiser Permanente's Capitol Hill Medical Center.
Outdoor safety is important all year long, but especially during warm weather months. One illness many children and adults can contract from spending time outdoors is Lyme disease. Lyme disease is an infection that is spread by ticks. In this area, deer ticks carry the bacteria that causes Lyme disease. Some of the symptoms of Lyme disease include a round red rash that spreads at the site of a tick bite. Flu-like symptoms, headaches, sore muscles and joints, and a fever are also common signs that you may have Lyme disease. Symptoms can start at any time and may not occur for up to a month after you have been bitten. The best way to protect yourself from Lyme disease is to cover up as much skin as you can when you're going to be in wooded or grassy areas. Be sure to check your body for ticks after spending time outdoors. Lyme disease is easily treated with antibiotics if caught early.
Dr. Kadlicek was recently recognized as a top doctor in Washingtonian Magazine. For more information, visit kp.org/midatlantic and click Meet Our Doctors.
This is NIH Health Matters. I'm Joe Belinfi. In order to best fight the increasing burden cancer has on global health, scientists worldwide are collaborating to increase understanding. Dr. Edward Trimble, a cancer and global health expert at NIH, explains.
We've learned a great deal about the molecular genetics of cancer, and we've learned that cancers are different in different parts of the world. And even in our own country, there are different types of lung cancer, different types of breast cancer.
Researchers are studying cancer samples from around the world in an attempt to learn more about these cancers and how to prevent and treat them. For more about the global burden of cancer, visit cancer.gov. Health Matters is produced by NIH, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Tom Temin here with a preview of Thursday's Federal Drive. Cybersecurity is becoming a legal issue for agencies. One expert says BYOA will be next. Bring your own attorney. Yikes. Plus, sequestration might be a financial hardship, but can it kill you? The Center for Effective Government comments on a new OSHA report. Austerity budgets threaten worker health and safety. Those stories and much more tomorrow morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, federalnewsradio.com. It's Pentagon Solutions. Hearing today highlights of an event hosted by the Heritage Foundation. Seth Cropsey, former Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy and now Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute, talking about his book, Mayday, The Decline of American Naval Supremacy, and also talking about the overall concept of naval power. In this highlight, Mr. Cropsey says a major change for the Navy in the Pacific region is a lack of clarity on what its mission objectives really are.
The rebalance to Asia, as the Obama administration terms it, does not clearly state what the objective of the rebalance is. If the rebalance is intended to counter growing Chinese military power in the region, the slight redistribution of U.S. naval forces away from the rest of the world and toward Asia that the administration has announced will not keep pace with China's arms buildup, won't keep peace either. And with nearly $500 billion already subtracted from the Defense Department in the first Obama administration, and the prospect that sequestration will remove an equal amount, where will the funds come from to build, deploy, and maintain a larger Pacific fleet in the future? A substantial portion of Mayday looks at the size of today's fleet and its prospects for growth in the future. But the prior question really is, to what end? I believe that our security is best served if we have a clear understanding of the strategy needed to secure our interests and those of our allies, but I don't think we do. Notwithstanding the question of the size of American sea power, the issue of the size of American sea power is quite serious. At the end of the Cold War, the U.S. combat fleet neared the goal that President Reagan set of 600 ships and 15 carrier battle groups. At approximately 285 ships, today's fleet is less than half that size. The goal of a 313-ship fleet toward which Navy had striven for the better part of the last decade has most recently been reduced to 306 ships. a three-star admiral who, up until his recent retirement, was responsible for naval warfare systems, predicted that without the contingency funds that have helped sustain military operations throughout the Middle Eastern wars, the size of the fleet would decrease to approximately 195 ships over the next 30 years. Both the Congressional Research Service and the Congressional Budget Office identify large gaps between the Navy's estimates of what's needed to reach a 306-ship fleet and the actual ship costs, inflation, and likely available funding. The Navy is asking for $14 billion for shipbuilding this year, regardless of sequestration. At the same time, Navy acknowledges that a shipbuilding budget of $18.8 billion per year is needed for each of the next 30 years to reach a 306-ship fleet. Congress's research arms say that Navy underestimates the true cost by $3 billion per year over the same 30-year period. That's quite a large difference. And sequestration, as you know, is a big matter. Prior to its implementation, the Navy sought to trim costs by not deploying the Truman Carrier Battle Group to the Middle East. This leaves a single carrier battle group there as warning signals that Iran is approaching nuclear status increase. Navy tied up seven surface combatants with many years of useful service life still left in them. The most direct way to save money is to reduce operations. Naval leadership accomplished this, reduced budget targets, but also diminished the distributed global presence of the U.S. combat fleet. In addition, several aircraft carrier wings' levels of training were reduced to minimum safe flying levels. This means that they would not be prepared for combat if there were a crisis. It would take time to prepare them. Four supply ships that served the U.S. Pacific Command were laid up, and that's particularly important because of the Pacific's immensity and our commensurate need to resupply vessels on patrol in its furthest reaches. No supply, no operations. Other cost savings measures for the first year of sequestration included a reduction in the number of escort ships that accompany the Nimitz carrier battle group and an early return to port of a frigate assigned to the U.S. Southern Command, which is responsible, among other things, for staunching the flow of illegal drugs from South and Central America into the United States. For now, the Navy will fail to meet its readiness standards for two-thirds of its non-deployed ships and aviation squadrons. As Chief of Naval Operations Admiral Jonathan Greenert told Congress earlier this year, and this is a quote, "We will not be able to respond in the way the nation has expected and depended on us." In short, and that's the end of his quote. In short, the Navy will meet sequestration by operating less while extending the deployments of ships at sea, which, ironically, increases the cost of repairing them, and also by buying fewer ships in the future. This will cut readiness. It will reduce the presence of our globally distributed fleet over the short term, as it diminishes American sea power's ability to recover that presence in the future by simply depriving it of ships. There's no good news here, and history offers sober proof. The states that achieve great power by taking the best advantage of their proximity to the seas and then forgot or lost their dominant sea power never recovered it. Athens ignored Pericles' advice to preserve the security and commercial advantages of its sea power and lost both the Peloponnesian War and its great power status.
Some historical perspective from Seth Cropsey, former Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy and now a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. He was at the Heritage Foundation to talk about his book, May Day, The Decline of American Naval Supremacy. You can find out more at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later today. And we have more from Mr. Cropsey in a moment on Pentagon Solutions on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Part of the Air Force Association's 2013 Air and Space Conference and Technology Exposition. Expand your horizons with this unique development opportunity by networking with senior Air Force leadership, industry experts, academia, and current aerospace specialists from around the world. The key speakers for the conference include the Acting Secretary of the Air Force, the U.S. Air Force Chief of Staff, the Chief Master Sergeant of the Air Force, and the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Visit AFA.org for more information and to register.
The Advanced Alliance Solutions Team, led by Technical and Management Resources, Inc., is a GSA Alliance small business contract holder. Here's President and CEO, Linda Carr.
The Advanced Alliance Solutions Team consists of seven IT firms. Collectively, our core competencies cover all of the functional areas of the Alliant contract and supports agencies' enterprise IT requirements. For potential small business teaming opportunities, please contact us at advancedalliant.com.
To learn more, visit advancedalliant.com.
The Mobility Report is brought to you by CDWG.
A suicide prevention mobile app is helping the Navy keep mental health patients in constant contact with their counselors. The app has live chatting capabilities to connect patients with the Navy's suicide prevention specialists at any time. It can also help patients plan a response for depression or suicidal thoughts. It also includes a GPS tracker for mental health facilities during an emergency. And for immediate assistance, the app has a button that will automatically call a suicide prevention hotline.
The mobile workforce. There's no doubt they're mobile, but can they work? If you're in federal IT, that's up to you. Visit cdwg.com/mobility to see how they can keep your people productive and your network secure. Sounds like a win-win. CDWG. People who get it.
Visit CDWG.com to learn how Lenovo laptops can provide your mobile workforce with all the tools they need to work on the go.
If talking and texting interferes with a walk down the street, imagine what might happen if you're driving. Focus on the road, not your conversation. Your brain can't do both safely. No dialing, no talking, no texting to arrive safe.
Hi, I'm Brooke Delaney.
And I'm Congressman John Delaney.
As a teen, I know not to text while driving. My dad and I ask you to focus on the road, not your conversation.
This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Hands, feet, mouths, and kids. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfus. With HHS HealthBeat, kids can give love, but they also can give a lot of diseases. One they share commonly is hand, foot, and mouth disease. Hand, foot, and mouth disease primarily affects children under 5, but it can affect older kids and adults. At the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Eileen Schneider says the disease is caused by a virus, so antibiotics won't cure it. Symptoms, such as mouth pain, can be treated.
You can help relieve symptoms by using a mouthwash or spray that numbs mouth pain. Over-the-counter medications can help reduce pain and fever, but children should never take aspirin.
Good hygiene, such as washing hands, can reduce the risk of transmission. Generally, the disease is mild and goes away after 7 to 10 days, but if you feel concerned, you can see a doctor. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfus.
Calling all government, military, and defense industry executives, the Association of the United States Army invites you to its 59th annual meeting and expo.
October 21st through the 23rd at the D.C. Convention Center, AUSA's annual meeting is one of the largest land warfare forums in the world.
Companies will gather to display the latest defense technology, and forums will be held for soldiers, family, government defense civilians, and industry executives.
Admission is free, limited to qualified persons. For details, visit AUSAannualmeeting.org.
Now your Federal News Radio cybersecurity update, afternoons at 30 minutes past the hour. The latest secret documents from leaker Edward Snowden detail al-Qaeda attempts to neutralize U.S. unmanned aircraft. The drones have killed some 3,000 people. The Washington Post reports intelligence officials have watched since 2010 as al-Qaeda tried to shoot down, jam, or hijack the drones. So far, they've had no success. U.S. drone strikes have decimated al-Qaeda and curtailed movement of its members. The Post didn't publish details about the cyber weaknesses in various models of aircraft. Members of the intelligence community have been posting them since 2006, according to the documents. You get your cybersecurity update afternoons at 30 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. You're listening to Pentagon Solutions today, highlights from an event hosted by the Heritage Foundation. Seth Cropsey, the speaker at this event, his book is called May Day, The Decline of American Naval Supremacy. Mr. Cropsey is former Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy, now a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. And you heard him talk about Athens in ancient Greece and how a decline of naval power led to its demise. In this highlight, Mr. Cropsey explains how that happened and why other historic failures look very similar to sequestration.
In its search for resources on land to build and supply its powerful fleet, Venice became entangled in the internecine warfare of the Italian city-states, ignored the transformation of naval architecture from inland sea vessels to ocean-going hulls and propulsion, and alienated its carrying trade partners by overtaxing them. The glorious city that its sea power created remains, but the power that made it possible ended nearly five centuries ago. The Dutch used their merchant fleet to establish Europe's most vibrant economy and figured that their wealth, unprotected by naval force, or at least protected by a very small one, would suffice. They learned the hard way that wealth is no guarantor of peace. Holland's small naval force made relatively easy pickings for the English and lost, the Dutch lost, never to recover, the maritime source of their power. England, burdened by the unexpectedly high cost of the Boer War and the idea that government debt at any level was an evil, began to abandon its global presence even before World War I. Today, the Royal Navy has 19 surface combatants. That's about less than a third of what it possessed as recently as the Falklands War. The likelihood that the British will reestablish their position as either a great power or a great maritime power is beyond my imagination. For a state whose greatness rests importantly on the economic and security benefits of seaborne trade, the ability to protect it and alliances sustained by naval force, the evaporation of dominant sea power equals the loss of national greatness. And although my book did not cover this subject in detail, it's worth noting here that the gathering debate within the Republican Party over America's engagement with the world, including the resources to support such engagement, is an ominous sign, not only for those who see the connection between a powerful U.S. and a more democratic and safe world, but for the world itself. As Britain began to give up its global reach before World War I, an ascendant U.S. was there, gradually to don an important part of the discarded mantle. If those within the Republican Party who, for reasons different from President Obama's, triumph, America's retreat to less influence and less participation in the world will offer neither stability nor prosperity. There is no powerful democratic state in the sidelines waiting to assume our current responsibilities. There is China. A less engaged, less powerful, more inwards-looking America will diminish the international demand for American products. It will risk and ultimately sunder our leadership position in Europe and Asia. And it will give birth to a new international order, one in which liberty, free markets, human rights, respect for territorial sovereignty, and freedom of navigation on the high seas are not priorities. I don't think any of us want to see this happen. And here, returning to the central theme of my book, I think that there are many steps we can take to prevent and reverse naval decline. This would mean acknowledging the importance of the strategic competition in which we find ourselves opposite China, while also emphasizing the importance of the Middle East and hemispheric defense. Such a declaration of priorities would help answer questions about the size and character of the U.S. fleet, and these questions continue to dog us today. The second step is greater discipline in the design and construction of naval vessels. Cost overruns have been a problem in recent years when we have seen the expense of the Navy's newest carrier greatly exceed original contractual obligation. The Navy's new destroyer met the same problems and the program was largely canceled. The littoral combat ship experienced similar issues initially, and the modular systems that allow the same littoral combat ship to perform different combat missions have yet to be built and deployed, and who knows, paid for. Similar accountability is needed throughout the entire Defense Department, whose organization for procurement is heavily centralized and looks like a relic of the Soviet Union. In general, the Office of the Secretary of Defense bureaucracy is huge, unwieldy, and unnecessarily expensive. It should be reduced, it should be made accountable, and key roles should be returned to the military services. At the same time, those parts of the 1986 legislation known as Goldwater-Nichols should be changed to reestablish the military service chief's responsibility for their service's strategic vision. This has largely migrated to the Office of the Secretary of Defense and the Joint Staff, Joint Chiefs. As Professor Samuel Huntington of Harvard, who died just a few years ago, observed in his famous 1954 article in Proceedings, military services that do not have a clear view of their strategic raison d'etre, he said, become purposeless and wallow about amid a variety of conflicting and confusing goals and ultimately suffer both physical and moral degeneration, end of quote. We should also move away from the political correctness of dividing the defense budget more or less equally among the military services. The 1986 legislation encouraged this, but it was not always so. President Eisenhower divided the military budget quite unevenly during the 1950s as he sought to improve the nation's nuclear deterrent, a mission in which the Army did not participate as extensively as the Air Force. I don't think I will surprise anybody here by saying that I'm pessimistic about the immediate future for our armed services and for the Navy in particular. But over the long run, I don't think that Americans have become isolationist. I don't believe that our fellow citizens would like to have a military that is second to any in the world. The question is whether we will, as a nation, realize the stakes soon enough to take effective corrective action. I wrote May Day to encourage the national discussion that I believe is needed to make these choices deliberately, consciously, not by default.
That's Seth Cropsey, former Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy and now a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, speaking at the Heritage Foundation. His book's called May Day, The Decline of American Naval Supremacy. You can read more about it, and you can find more about this presentation at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. When we come back, more from Mr. Cropsey on Pentagon Solutions on In-Depth with Francis Rose.
They say a picture is worth a thousand words. Well, picture your family and home safe and secure with Ackerman Security Systems. Picture yourself controlling your system remotely on your mobile phone anytime, anywhere. Picture yourself getting video clips and texts of happenings at home before your kids get home from school. Picture everything you can do with the money saved by choosing Ackerman Security.
There's good reason Ackerman Security Systems is the Washington area's most trusted security company. It's because at Ackerman, security is all they do, and they do it better than anyone else. For just $18.95 a month, Ackerman monitors your home for burglary, fire, and medical alert. Already have a system? Switch for free and start saving. Call by Wednesday and get up to 3 months of basic monitoring free. Call 888-999-1070. AckermanSecurity.com.
The Veterans Affairs Department struggles to fix long-standing cyber vulnerabilities. Members of Congress question whether the personal data of 20 million veterans is being properly protected. And at a recent hearing, lawmakers learned VA's networks were breached several times by nation states. Federal News Radio explores VA's cyber issues and what's being done to fix the problems in our ongoing special report, VA Cyber Efforts in the Hot Seat. Find it all at federalnewsradio.com. Search VA Cyber.
The Military Officers Association of America and the National Defense Industrial Association will host the annual Warrior Family Symposium, a forum for discussing mental health and the challenges facing our warriors and family members, on September 12th from 7:30 to 2:30 at the Ronald Reagan Building and International Trade Center. Space is limited. Visit warriorfamilysymposium.com to register. All active and retired military or guard and their spouses can attend for free. That's warriorfamilysymposium.com for more information.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on In Depth with Francis Rose. Today, hearing highlights from an event at the Heritage Foundation with Seth Cropsey. He's former Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy and now a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, talking about his book, Mayday, The Decline of American Naval Supremacy. And in your DOD report, brought to you by BAE Systems, afternoons at 40 minutes after the hour, he takes some questions about specific problems with the Navy. He starts this highlight by comparing the competition between the United States and China and what would happen if the two powers collide.
Today, I don't think that there'd be much of a contest between the U.S. Navy and the Chinese Navy. I'm concerned about what things are going to look like 30 years from now, or even 20 years from now. Because if you combine sequestration with the budget cuts that have already taken place, and even more important than that, those are signs of the American public's sort of kind of forgetting the importance of naval power. If that forgetfulness is extended and we're not reminded how important the dominance at sea is, I think that the long-term trend is very serious for the United States, because China is modernizing its fleet, it's building a larger one. They have an aircraft carrier now that they didn't have a year ago at sea. It's going to take them time to learn how to operate it effectively and safely. There are plans for a second one. A lot of our senior officers are saying, well, it's only two. Well, it's only two today, but try to think about what things will look like three decades from now. The Navy's responsible for doing that. It has to report to Congress on where it's going to be 30 years from now. And the reason that I pointed out the difference between the Navy's estimates of what it will take to reach a reduced fleet and Congress's estimates is exactly the answer to your point, which is we're not getting to where we need to go. We're going in the opposite direction. And if this ends up in a situation where the United States is required to pull its ships from everywhere else in the world in order to deter or convince China that it's not a good idea to think about going to war with the United States. We've done the British thing. We're no longer a dominant global power. We can only apply force in one place in particular when it's necessary. That's what I'm concerned about. It's the future.
Thank you very much. I'm Jeffrey Lynn from Senator Angus King's office. And my question, sir, is regarding the sort of fast pace of technological change, because, for instance, as you rightly pointed out, the Navy has to institute better discipline in its shipbuilding and design practice. But on the other hand, how can we balance that with the need to make bets on future technologies that could be game changers in naval warfare? Thank you very much.
Designing and building new technology does not equal cost overruns. One of the major reasons for cost overruns is, and perhaps the most significant one is, you decide you're going to build a particular ship, like the littoral combat ship, right, or the new carrier into which new combat systems are being engineered for the first time. And as you're building the ship, one or two or ten or a hundred of your prime contractor or your secondary contractors, the people you do business with, come along and say, hey, I have a better idea for doing this than the one that we had originally agreed to. It's going to cost you a little bit more. And if you say, okay, let's do it once, no problem. If you say it 1,000 times, big problem. So being disciplined about answering those issues would be a large step forward in introducing the cost discipline that I'm talking about into a system that has had trouble maintaining it over the years. It does not mean that we are not able to take care, that we're not able to take advantage of rail guns or electronically launched catapults. I mean, it's unfortunately a matter sort of being nibbled to death by ducks. You know, another idea here. You add all those up, and you have, you know, an $860 million overrun on an aircraft carrier.
That's Seth Cropsey speaking at the Heritage Foundation. He is author of the book Mayday, The Decline of American Naval Supremacy, speaking about that book at this event. Mr. Cropsey, former Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy, now a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. And we'll wrap up our coverage of his presentation in a moment on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
The Pentagon and Beyond is brought to you by EADS North America.
What's the U.S. military plan for Syria?
Military objectives in Syria would be to hold the Assad regime accountable, degrade its ability to carry out these kinds of attacks, and deter the regime from further use of chemical weapons.
Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel told the Senate they're just waiting for the order.
The Department of Defense has developed military options to achieve these objectives, and we have positioned U.S. assets throughout the region to successfully execute this mission.
I'm J.J. Green.
Meet James Noel, another U.S. veteran and EADS North America employee building the Lakota helicopter for the U.S. Army.
You know, you're looking at about 50% veterans that work at this company here in Mississippi. Being a veteran myself and knowing that I'm a part of building an aircraft the military is using, it's an honor. We're on time, on cost, and on quality. That speaks for itself. And I'd have the well-rested nights knowing that our troops are in this aircraft.
EADS North America. Commitment defines us.
And now, Technology Insights with Tom Frana, President and CEO of Vion Corporation, speaking with Vion's Chief Technology Officer, Carl Fulp, about go-to-market strategies.
If you look at the marketplace today, how much time do you have to spend making sure what we're bringing to market meets current needs?
That's a continual ongoing effort through the go-to-market process to make sure that we constantly keep the technology up to speed. So for instance, for a solution, we may replace a particular server because there's a new server in the marketplace which has greater efficiencies or greater capacity. So it's an ongoing effort. But I want to get the solution right to begin with.
Vion and Hitachi Data Systems Federal Corporation develop IT services and solutions delivered by Vion. This proven 33-year partnership helps agencies improve IT cost and agility by being responsive, creative, and committed. Tap into the power of teaming with Vion. Visit Vion.com.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m., right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. The Office of Financial Innovation and Transformation, known as FIT, was created by OMB to reduce the costs of financial systems, improve the quality and usefulness of financial data, and provide standards for processing financial data throughout individual federal agencies. Join AFSIA Bethesda and top agency officials September 25th at the Bethesda North Marriott and Conference Center to discuss what FIT initiatives are being implemented and tested across government agencies, as well as industry's role with the federal shared service providers and CRS.
We're back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. You're listening to Pentagon Solutions today. Seth Cropsey is who you're hearing. He is a former Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy and now a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. His latest book is Mayday, The Decline of American Naval Supremacy. In this highlight, he answers a question about an issue that plagues every Navy around the world, not just the United States.
Al Milliken, AM Media. The acts of international piracy, what more would you say about the U.S. Navy and other national Navy responses to that?
I think that the initial responses to piracy off the Horn of Africa were appropriate. They were useful. It seems to me, though, that the merchant marine, that the merchants running ships who've trained their crews and armed some of them have been at least as effective as naval force. I mean, it's a huge area that the pirates have operated in. And if we put half the Navy, our Navy, into the area there, we still couldn't guarantee safety. I think the measures that have been taken by the shipping companies have been at least as successful as naval action in decreasing the piracy incidents in off the Horn of Africa.
Colonel Friedman, I'm U.S. Army. Just regarding technology and the advances in technology, both air and sea, I was wondering how that affected the final projected number of how many ships we need, and what's your projection of what we need as far as a number? I know you talked about 306 and 311, but what do you think the ideal number should be?
Well, you know, there's the Quadrennial Defense Review, right, the QDR. And by congressional requirement, there's the answer to the QDR is required. A different point of view is required. And the most recent one recommended a fleet of 350 ships. I think that's a sensible point. I think that's a sensible figure. It would allow the United States to maintain a three-hub Navy based on a presence in the Western Pacific, in the Middle East, and in this hemisphere. I think that's the most sensible approach. We don't need a 600-ship Navy today. There is some truth that there is truth in the assertion that increasing technology diminishes the need for a large fleet. But it's not a if you look at this as a calculus problem, it turns into insanity. I mean, if you could, for example, put the entire combat power of the Navy into one ship, do you want to do that? No, because one ship can't be in three places, can't be in two places at once. So 350 is, I think, about the right number. That might decrease as technology improves. I mean, for example, if we start producing, we're talking about naval guns that, with the assist of rocket power, could have a range of up to 200 miles. Well, if you can do 200 miles and you could make that 2,000 miles, it's kind of hard to imagine, but, you know, tell Captain Isaac Hull of the Constitution that ships of the U.S. Navy would be able to fire shells 200 miles, and he'd say, you must be nuts. So who knows? But for today, with today's technology, I think 350 is the right number.
That is Seth Cropsey, the former Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy and Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute now, speaking at the Heritage Foundation, talking about his book, Mayday, The Decline of American Naval Supremacy, on Pentagon Solutions Today. You can read more about the book and find the presentation at the Heritage at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.